I will call the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We have a quorum. Representative Frazier, have you had a moment to review the minutes? Oh, all right. Representative Finke, have you had a moment to review the minutes? Awesome. Awesome to hear. We always like fantastic minutes. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor of passage of the minutes, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. We have a fairly light agenda today. So the first bill on the docket is House File 1917. Representative Paul Anderson, Chair Anderson, welcome to the committee. I don't know that I've ever seen you in this committee before. Maybe you have been, but in the years past, but welcome. And I will move House File 1917, and the recommendation is that it be re-referred to the Committee on Election Finance and GovOps. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to members. This is my first time in the Judiciary Committee. I'm usually in the fields or on the Ag Committee around here. This bill, 1917, House File 1917, deals with the public data law. And looking back, in brief history, this goes back to the 1990s. It was amended in 2012. And before that time, only information on state officials could be considered public. And the amendment added in 2012 added the local officials to that same law, but it added a population threshold to the law, the public data law. And what this bill does, Madam Chair and members, is that it takes those population numbers out on page 3, line 8 and 9. So it would remove that population threshold and make all local officials as well subject to this public data law here in the state of Minnesota. We have a testifier, I believe. At least he said he was going to be here.
Representative Anderson, okay. Mr. Ealing, welcome to the committee. Come on up to the table. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Matt Ealing, Minnesotans for Open Government. I'm here today to speak in favor of HF 1917. We thank Representative Anderson for bringing this forward. And also want to thank Senator Howe, who has worked on this particular bill for about 5 years trying to get this through the process and correct something in the statute we think needs fixing. So this is an important bill. We believe that it will correct language that should never have been placed in the Data Practices Act to begin with. As Representative Anderson has mentioned, this was added about a decade or so ago when the personnel section of the Act was updated to clarify disclosure buyout agreements for public employees. Some other amendments were made at that same time related to public officials and what data is available about complaints regarding those public officials in certain circumstances, including when a public official resigns after a complaint has been filed. So the current language in the public official definition in 1343 makes a distinction. It draws a distinction between large cities and counties and smaller cities and counties. In cities over 7,500 or counties over 5,000, public officials include chiefs, managers, heads of departments, divisions, or boards, or any equivalent position. In smaller cities and counties, those same positions are not necessarily covered, which puts citizens in greater Minnesota and in smaller populated areas of the state at a disadvantage relative to people who live in larger cities and counties. So if you live in Eagan, for instance, and your fire chief resigns after a complaint is filed, you would be able to discover the substance of what that complaint was about, since the data underlying the complaint is classified as public for that size of a city. However, if you live in a small town, you would not necessarily be able to discover that same data set given those same set of facts. And so we believe this population-based distinction is arbitrary and should be corrected, and that's what this bill does. John Finnegan, the late editor of the Pioneer Press newspaper, who was the key mover behind the Data Practices Act during its inception, he believed that public data should be public for everybody. He didn't want to see distinctions drawn so that some folks would have access to some piece of public data and others wouldn't. It should be in equal measure doled out to the members of the public. So we support the bill. Happy to take any questions, and thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Any member questions? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate your testimony. I have two cities in my district that are under 7,500 people, so I just want to make sure that I understand what the change would mean practically. So first of all, I'm wondering why we put this in the first place. I don't know if House Research or somebody has an answer to why specifically this added in.
It looks like Mr. Ealing might have an answer, and then we go to House Research.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Finke, so this was negotiated back, I believe, in 2012, so it was just before I came on the board. Don Gemberling, who's on our board, was aware of those negotiations, and what happened basically is that as these things happen here at the legislature, when an issue comes forward, there's a scrum of stakeholders that all want to jump into the bill and have their piece of it heard and have it resolved the way they want to. So my understanding, based on talking to Mr. Gemberling, is that at that time, smaller municipalities and their stakeholders and lobbyists got this threshold in. We've thought it's, as an organization, we thought it's wrong from the beginning, but that was the resolution reached at that time during that negotiation.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hopkins, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair and members, I think that's the sort of a very good sort of real politic kind of explanation for the conclusion. There are a few places in Chapter 13 where the application of the law depends on the size of a city or county. Typically, that's because in smaller cities and counties, either compliance is too much of a burden on a small city or county without the resources to fully comply with a complicated law. Here, a smaller city or county, typically, you know, people are going to know each other better. You're going to know your mayor, know your fire chief. If it's a smaller city or a smaller county, people know each other more. So there's it could be seen as there's less of a need for mandated transparency when there's a smaller population.
Thank you. Representative Finke, I don't know if Mr. Ealing, the other part of your question was what's the practical outplay of this. I don't know if Mr. Ealing has an idea or, you want to weigh on that,
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, let me just walk you back through the statute as it's evolved over time. As Representative Anderson has mentioned, this provision that allows certain public officials to be defined and have their data disclosed, particularly if they resign in the midst of a complaint being filed or if they're terminated after a complaint's been filed, that started with state employees. Senator Marty first got that into law several years ago because of a situation that he encountered where a state employee had resigned in the midst of a sort of political brouhaha, and there was a lot of questions about what did this person actually do, but the data laws in the personnel section didn't allow the disclosure of that because there was no final disposition of a disciplinary action. So that's how it started to get into statute. And then in 2012, during that negotiation, the addition of these other local officials, local public officials at a county and city level, were added. So the primary effect of this, from our perspective, is when you have those resignations after a complaint's been filed, but before any kind of disciplinary action has been meted out. Under the personnel section, generally, if you're going to get the data underlying a complaint, you're only going to get it after the final disposition of a disciplinary action. And this is a way to sort of have an exception and a release valve for information about certain key public officials before that final disposition happens.
And I think, too, and I'll let you follow up on that, Representative Finke, I think, too, part of the concern is a lot of time there's a lump sum like severance or a settlement that's made with taxpayer dollars, and then the taxpayers can't really find out what the final settlement was. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I guess I don't want people to be able to resign and hide their evil deeds, to be clear. I'm not opposing this. I just am trying to figure out, like, you know, I represent Lauderdale, a city of 2,000 people that doesn't really have these officials, right? We have a mayor and a couple of council members. So I'm just curious, if this passes, like, what will they have, like, what changes for them, right? Nothing? Or can people make data requests that they couldn't make before? Is there a cost? to those folks? And I saw I read the League of Minnesota Cities letter, but I'd be interested to have, if they're here, if they would be able to, like, just practically speaking, Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, two small cities that I represent, what are the consequences of this to them?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Ealing, and then we'll ask if there's a league person here. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finke, just as a closing comment on our part, we think that ultimately this is not a huge pile of information that's currently not available to the public, because you have to have several thresholds that all come together. You've got to have a complaint. There's got to be some kind of data that underlies the complaint. And you know, you have to have somebody that's underneath that population threshold that's in the statute right now. So you're not talking about an endless amount of data that's not being released right now, but it's important to the people who pursue it in those circumstances where they can't get it in a small city. And so in terms of the cost, you know, we know people always raise cost concerns about bills like this, but we think that because of the data you're dealing with, these are complaints about public officials that do important functions for the public. There's often taxpayer money involved in settlement agreements or you know, buyouts or something like that. The cost of not releasing this kind of information is higher than any kind of nominal cost of processing the data request, because, you know, who knows, you could have, you know, there's monetary costs in terms of potential litigation stemming from bad actions. There's also a loss of public trust, which is also a cost if people can't find out what really happened.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Is there someone here from the League of Minnesota Cities? Come on to the table. Please state your name for the record, and if you could respond to Representative Finke's questions, that would be great.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee. My name is Tori Key. I am an Intergovernmental Relations Representative from the League of Minnesota Cities. Representative Finke, thank you so much for your question. We did attempt to determine how much of an impact this might have in terms of smaller cities that are going to be getting more data requests of this like. It's hard to determine. I can say that the language of the bill does say that it, you know, it's after the final disposition, or sorry, the language of the statute right now, the part that's not being changed, after the final disposition of any charge or complaint. I think that could include discipline against these officials, and that would be more information that those cities would then have to divulge in terms of employees that might have titles such as manager or director. Especially in smaller cities, those folks might be one of five employees, right? And so they're automatically going to be a manager. They perhaps might not have a lot of authority in a city, like you would think of as the chief executive officer or the mayor or something along those lines. And that would include those folks who now will be subject to this provision, where that information of any complaint or charge against them could be requested from the public. We already know that there's a lot of data requests coming in, so this would likely just add to the number of data requests that cities are seeing.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time, and I appreciate everyone's responses. I don't think I have a problem with this bill. I just want to make sure that I fully understand it. There are these very small urban cities that kind of get lost, I think, in a lot of conversations that we're having. I've heard this from our council members, both in Lauderdale and Falcon Heights, that when we're talking about small cities, we forget about urban small cities that don't receive the funding that even greater Minnesota cities sometimes do. So I just want to make sure that we are sort of remembering all of our constituents who are facing these sort of relatively unique circumstances. So I appreciate the bill. I appreciate your answers. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions were along the same line, and I guess I don't want to repeat anything, but I support the underlying goals here. And I was just curious, it does not seem like there would be that many of these complaint, like it would have to be a scenario where there was a complaint or a charge against a public official. So, you know, there are certain types of data requests that are very voluminous, and like people can use them as a way to just achieve another agenda through data requests. It doesn't seem to me like that would be the case here, because it seems fairly narrow, the circumstances in which these types of data would become available. And I'm just curious if there is any like data around how frequent these types of scenarios arise? Like, how often is this going to happen in Lauderdale, for Lauderdale, not Fort Lauderdale. It's like right next to me. I should know that. anyway, like how common is this? Do we know? Mr. Ealing, or I'm so sorry, I forgot your name with the leaf of Minnesota.
That's Ms. Key.
Ms. Key.
So if either one of you want to take, or both want to take a stab at that.
I can take that. So I spoke with our data practices specialist at the league. She formerly was with a metro city. And we, again, couldn't kind of determine exactly how often this would occur. We estimate that there's probably about 25% of data practices requests related to personnel data, just like at large across the state. But that tends to be these, they call them like open book requests for name, salary, title. And since right now this only applies to those cities over 7,500 in population, which is 30 or so. Those are also going to be those large cities like the St. Paul's and Minneapolis's that are currently getting these requests. So we don't have any direct information on how this specific change would impact it or what requests are currently coming under this section.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ealing. You have any ideas?
Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Feist, we don't have any statistical information to provide. We hear anecdotes once in a while about these kinds of issues. I mean, the anecdote that's driving this bill is from Senator Howe, who had a chief of police resign in St. Joe, in the midst of some kind of kerfuffle, and because there was no final disposition of disciplinary action, no one could release the underlying data about what really happened. And so that motivated him to bring this bill. And we've heard occasionally other stories like that. So, again, I don't have any statistics. We don't think, based on our experience, that it's a huge number.
Representative Feist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It doesn't seem to me like it is a huge number, just based on the answers here. It seems like this is a fairly niche issue, but an important one. So that's just kind of my takeaway. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Mangan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson. I'm in favor of radical transparency in government across the board. I think that this is a good bill. And hearing about some of those costs and what that would do to a city who would have to comply with this, I don't think that that's necessarily a justification as to why we would disincentivize or create some of those roadblocks to accessing this data. In fact, I think it increases public trust if there are cases in which it draws a larger or a more immense public outcry for that data to just simply release it rather than provide it on a case-by-case basis. Like Representative Feist said, this is probably a niche issue where it's occurring after one of those more high-profile cases within a smaller city. So if we do that, it's 2 cents of unsolicited advice, but I think it's going to increase transparency as well as public trust in our institutions. So thank you.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Hold on to your seats. I agree with Representative Engen.
All right.
I just wanted to point out one thing in the letter from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I completely understand anytime we give direction to city that they might have to do something more that is not currently being done. That can cost time and resources, right? And I think we all understand that. But to Rep. Engen's point, like the importance of what that practice is, I believe outweighs what the potential cost of that is, especially when we're talking about the population of the cities that we're discussing here. The smaller the city, the smaller those that list of public officials is. Mm-hmm. I think in a small town, the smaller it gets, the fewer and fewer folks that we're actually talking about when it comes to this private data and this public data. In the letter, this is a question for the league. I understand it's challenging to estimate the volume of data, sort of in the closing statements in the letter. The letter states that the aggregate impact would be significant, and I'm curious how a city in a small town in northwestern Minnesota of 500 people, how their cost added to Falcon Heights. I'm trying to figure out the conclusion there of adding up their costs and how that leads to greater impact for anyone, because what I'm seeing is that northwestern small town has their cost, and Falcon Heights has their cost, and I'm not seeing how that can be considered to add up to anything more.
Ms. Key?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that question. I like how you framed that. I think we're looking at it from the holistic point of view of the number of data requests that are coming in across the state, and it's already becomes a burden on a lot of small cities who maybe only have one staff member who manages everything, and now their time might be spent responding to new, you know, when there is a high-profile event, there may be 10 or 20 new requests coming in for this data, that instead of spending their time on normal administrative tasks, running the city, doing payroll, whatever it is they need to do with their day, they're instead pulling these files and getting those out to the folks. So that's where that comes from in terms of a lot of the things that we've been seeing with data requests and the trends that we've seen in increases. This would just further add to that.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. And so I can appreciate where you're coming from and sort of saying, like, collectively, cities across Minnesota might see this increase, right? But what I'm not seeing is a connection where Falcon Heights is going to spend money and then a small town, you know, greater Minnesota will be affected by the money that Falcon Heights or Lauderdale spends, right? Mm-hmm. Or Gem Lake or any other small city. And so I'm not getting that connection there. I think transparency is a really clearly important thing. And I do think hopefully this would be, as Rep. Feist said, very limited cases that we would see. And hopefully even more limited after increasing requirements of transparency, right? To try to deter some of that behavior. So thank you, Chair.
All righty, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this, Representative Anderson. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about it. I think we're always in a balancing act when we're talking about data. It doesn't all lean one way or the other. I think we all would like to see a lot of transparency, and that's a good thing. There's also a privacy interest, which I think Mr. Hopkins kind of alluded to, that in some small cities, small towns, you might, you know, there's, so all of these things always have to be balanced out. Certainly where it does seem arbitrary, Mr. Ealing, this is, you know, why, you know, you pick a number and why that number as opposed to some other number. So I agree that this is kind of ripe for making a change. But just a suggestion, if the concern is that there might be a payout of some kind, that public funds are being paid out where there's no transparency, you could always make a change that says if you're paying out public funds, then there has to be transparency. So just a suggestion, if you, as this bill moves along, if you want to finesse this some way, if you start to hear a lot of crying from small cities, which you very well might, and I have to note that probably most of the smaller towns and cities are represented more by Republicans than Democrats in the state, and you might get some pushback as people start to hear about this, you might consider whether there could be a finer distinction there to be sure that certainly if there's a payout, the public has a right to know why. Just a suggestion. Thank you.
Any, I just wanted to make one more comment about on behalf of the bill, and that is by making this information public, you're also making it public to other potential employers for that person that's been a bad actor to be on notice. If it's never revealed, that might become somebody else's problem, that the sort of behavior that got, you know, whatever led up to these charges. So. For that reason, you know, I think it's an important reason. So they don't go from Falcon Heights to, I don't know, the next smaller city, and where there's the same problem. So, with that, Representative Anderson, any final comments?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think we talked about the city of St. Joe, and they were, I think, 700 under that threshold of $7,500 to have that information made public. So that's where the frustration came in. And I'm from a small town, you know, 1,100 people, although I live on a farm. But and I think the point made earlier that the smaller the town, the less likely something like this is going to happen. I mean, small towns usually get along pretty well, and we all know each other, and things are pretty well out in the open. So, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that the House file not, well, you have to renew that
I do.
Motion, but I would encourage a positive vote.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Thanks for a good discussion here this morning. I will renew my, well, first of all, anybody else in the public wishing to testify? All right, seeing none. I renew my motion that House File 1917 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Election Finance and GovOps. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to GovOps. Thanks, Representative Anderson. Our next bill on the agenda is Representative Moeller, fresh back from presenting a bill in capital investment. Sure, you bet. Well, we got the superstar panel here at the end of the horseshoe table here. Let's see. So the Representative Moeller, I would ask you to move your bill, and the motion would be that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. The bill is before us, House File 1083. And go ahead and tell us about your bill. I believe there's an amendment.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And at this point, we're not going to be offering the amendment. And I'll briefly mention why as when I talk about the bill. That's all right. I will.
Yep, go ahead.
Great. I'll explain the bill. Well, first, thank you so much for giving this bill a hearing. For those of you who were here in the last session, you will probably recognize this bill. We almost made it across the finish line, but not quite. What House File 1083 does is provides protections for domestic violence victim survivors in line with the protections that are currently in the privilege statute for sexual assault survivors. It make sure that important communications can be had between those victim survivors and their advocates. It's in the same statute that provides other privileges like attorney-client privilege, like patient-doctor privilege. Again, because those communications are so important, we want to make sure that people are able to say what they need to say to get the services that they need. What's strange about the domestic violence privilege statute currently is that it carves out an exception to allow disclosure of these important communications. And this really does have an impact of potentially chilling those important conversations that victim survivors need to have with their advocates. And you'll see in the letters, too, there's some confusion. There are some advocates who are both sexual assault and domestic violence advocates, and there are victims who are victims of both types of crimes. And it's really confusing then to parse out which privilege applies, the one for sexual assault victims that's absolute or the one for domestic violence victims. And you will also notice that the definition of domestic violence advocates, it's defined in statute. And this applies to community-based advocates. These are not state actors. And I think sometimes there's confusion about who these folks are. People who work for the county attorney's office, for example, who are victim witness advocates, are not domestic violence advocates under the definition of this bill. Those folks have to disclose that information if it gets to law enforcement, the prosecution, to the defense. So there are adequate protections in place for defendants' due process rights. Just a brief mention about the amendment. Last year, we had opposition from the Minnesota Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers, MACDL. I did reach out to them, and we are in discussions with a potential amendment to address their concerns. I shared this language. They haven't had a time yet to fully make a decision about it, and I think that we do need a little more work on this language, but I'm hopeful that with something like this, we'll be able to get there. And I do believe Representative Rarick was going to make a comment as well.
Representative Berry, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be on this side. So this is a really important bill for fairness and clarity. I think those are the two most important things to understand. You've got a sexual violence advocate and a domestic violence advocate. and they have completely different rules that they have to follow. It's not good for them. It's not good for the victim. And there is a lot of overlap between a domestic violence victim and sexual assault victim. It often is co-occurring. So this is an incredibly important thing. I'm not sure why we haven't fixed this in the past. We had some issues in the Senate. So hopefully we'll get it passed this year and make that the fairness and the clarity happen, because those are the most important things about what this bill does.
Thanks, Chair Werick. And I believe you have a testifier. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Scott and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Raina Alexander, and I am here to speak in support of House File 1083. A victim once told me, if what I did and said are going to be used against me, why did I even seek help in the first place? Domestic violence is an underreported crime. Among the many reasons victims give for not reporting or seeking help is the loss of anonymity and privacy that comes with engaging with the criminal justice system. Access to confidential advocacy services, crisis support, and ongoing counseling are critical to the health, recovery, and safety of domestic violence victims. Working with a community-based domestic violence advocate can provide safe, confidential, and non-judgmental opportunity for a victim of domestic violence to consider all available options while addressing any pressing needs, including crisis support and access to services in responding to the trauma they have experienced. In 2008, the Minnesota legislature, without a single no vote or any objection, recognized that the public interest in domestic violence victims' health and safety rises to the level of justifying the creation of a specific privilege to protect this confidential information. We are now asking that the legislature to update this statute to bring it in line with the sexual assault counselor privilege. In 2022, a Minnesota Supreme Court decision found the sexual assault counselor privilege was to be an absolute privilege. However, the domestic abuse advocate privilege was found to have broad exceptions, including that the court could order disclosure of an advocate's records and conversations. This means if a domestic violence victim seeks support from a domestic abuse advocate, and their conversations are not strictly privileged, the court could order disclosure. Considering between 40 to 45% of women in abusive relationships also will be sexually assaulted in the course of that relationship, if the same domestic violence victim was to speak to a sexual assault counselor, that conversation would be strictly privileged. In addition, because of lack of funding, many programs serve both domestic and sexual violence victim survivors, which means the victim could tell their story to one advocate, and that part of the story about sexual violence would be strictly privileged, and the part about domestic violence would not be. This leaves victims and domestic violence advocates unclear about whether their conversations are privileged or not. Domestic violence victims deserve to have the same protected conversations with domestic abuse advocates that they can have with a sexual assault counselor. Over the last 18 years, I have represented at least 23 domestic and sexual violence programs and had over 800 conversations in attempts to gain access to their confidential records against the wishes of a victim. Victims often express feeling re-victimized by the system when their records from a domestic violence program are sought. Domestic violence victims expect and have the right to expect that the fact they sought help from a domestic violence program will not become known outside of that agency. They expect and have the right to expect that the type and extent of services that they will need will remain confidential and private between them and the agency. They expect and have the right to expect their names or personal information will not end up in a document that is produced in court. Victims have the right to expect one thing: confidential, private help with domestic violence they have experienced. Federal and state laws support this expectation. Minnesota's domestic abuse privilege needs to be amended so we can honor their privacy. Thank you, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Alexander. Representative Curran is on the list.
That was quick. All right, thank you, Chair. First, Chair Werick, Chair Moeller, thank you so much for bringing this before us again. And I'm so disappointed that you have to bring this in front of us again. And Chair Werick, you were so kind in your words of how this went last biennium. And I'm going to shoulder some of that for you right now. I had the honor of sitting on the conference committee with the Senate both times, 23 and 24. And if folks haven't seen Chair Mueller's comments when we had to take this out of conference committee to make a budget work. I invite folks to go back and watch it. It was a pretty powerful moment, and I'm feeling that right now. I think it is shameful and despicable that we dealt with one legislator who held power in the Senate who disliked this bill. I'm really, really, really disappointed in how that went down. And I thank you again for your kindness and your comments. But I'm not going to be so kind about it today. I think we have really got to protect information when it comes to folks who are victims of domestic abuse, sexual assault. Fully understanding the nuances of what your rights are as a defendant. But the arguments that we have gotten in opposition to this are so thin and to me are just, again, despicable. We should not and we never should treat victims in this way and divulge in deeply personal and upsetting information just because, you know, somebody who, I'll say allegedly, harmed them might have something to gain, right? We know how these cases go. We know the power that abusers hold over victims and survivors. So I just, you know, going back to the conversations we had last session, I know in public safety when this came up, we had full bipartisan support, and I'm so grateful that we had that then. I'm really hopeful that we will have it now, and that when we get to the end of this thing this year, that we make a strong stance together, that this isn't a partisan issue. This isn't an issue for the Senate to shoot down. This is the right thing to do for Minnesotans. And I'm on team not taking no for an answer. So thank you.
Representative Steer.
All right, thank you. I do support this bill 100%. I'm just wondering about the line 4.11 where it says, allowed to disclose any opinion of information received, and then for the mandated reporter statute where it says that in Minnesota domestic violence advocates are considered mandated reporters if a mandated reporter knows or has reason to believe a child is being neglected, physically or sexually abused by a parent or guardian. I just want to make sure that we're not stopping that mechanism from happening.
Representative Mueller. Okay. To the testifier, Ms. Alexander.
I apologize. I'm not clear on where you were because there's the language of the statute does not say that specifically that domestic abuse advocates are mandated reporters.
Representative Steer or Mr. Johnson's ready to pipe in too. So.
Right. They're only mandated reporters if they learn about child abuse or vulnerable adult abuse.
Let's go to Mr. Johnson.
Chair Scott, members, Representative Steer, I think you can find your answer if you look at lines 4.16 and 4.17 of the bill. There is an exception that is in current law that would continue to exist, and those references are the mandated reporting requirements, and so the prohibition on disclosure would not apply to those mandated reporting requirements.
Are you good, Mr. Representative Steer? You're good. Okay. What was that?
I just said you got to protect the kids. I wanted to make sure that we were watching out for them.
Yep. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives Mueller and Rarick. So I don't know if I'm on team don't take no for an answer, but I am on team productively skeptical, right? So I like the basic idea of what this bill is trying to do. I actually, Representative Feist, you and I need to have a conversation about one of your bills that does something similar in terms of providing protections for people who are trying to work through stuff, right? But what I'm concerned about is a couple of potential scenarios that could develop. One where someone who's acting in good faith, a victim who's acting in good faith, trying to work things out with an advocate, discloses information that could potentially be used in the event that their abuser goes all the way and kills them, right? Past that point, they no longer have the ability to consent as to whether or not their information is going to be disclosed or not disclosed. But that act justifies the evidence that's been acquired being used to prosecute their murderer. The other scenario is information that could potentially be exculpatory in terms of, you know, somebody's being wrongfully accused and there's evidence of that that's disclosed through this process that because of the prohibition on disclosure in this bill doesn't get to be part of the process. My only question is, has that been thought through? Am I wrong about my perceptions of these potential loopholes? And also, if I'm not, is there an opportunity to work on scenarios like that? Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for that questions, plural. I'll start with the exculpatory piece of it first. And again, these are community-based. They're not state actors. And so when we're talking about the due process rights to turn over exculpatory information, that applies to state actors. Doesn't apply to these the domestic violence shelters, for example. And the Hope Coalition case really addressed that too in the context of sexual assault privilege and said that this doesn't violate the defendant's constitutional rights. So I think that's really important. A lot of times what happens in these prosecutions is that the defense will make a request for like any and all records that a sexual assault or domestic violence victim has provided. I've seen it for mental health records. I've seen it for medical records. I've seen it for advocacy records. And then the courts had too frequently just been saying, oh, we'll do an in-camera review, and then we'll decide if there's anything over to turn over to the defense, which was extremely harmful to victims. It is re-traumatizing, and it does really prevent victims from sharing the information they need to share. So that's sort of the problem we're trying to fix, was how that's been overused. And again, if there's any conversations that are given to the prosecution with the victim's consent or law enforcement, they absolutely have to be disclosed to the defense. And that's what we're trying to figure out with the amendment. And I think we'll get there with that language. On the flip side of that, these privileges do apply, whether it's the defense or the prosecution seeking these. I don't know if I've heard of a case where a prosecution's trying to get them to be able to prove, for example, a homicide case, a domestic violence past pattern. I think my testifier could probably give more examples where they have prosecutions has been trying to seek these. But again, the privilege applies to anybody that's trying to seek these records. And I think in those scenarios where if the victim does end up dying, there would be other investigative tools that they could use to prove past pattern. And remember that if the victim said anything to an advocate in that case, it's going to be hearsay. It's probably not going to be allowed in court anyway. And I don't know if my testifier had more.
Ms. Alexander, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, thank you very much. First of all, I do want to reference a United States Supreme Court decision and Swindler and Berlin, where the court said, we have said that the loss of evidence admittedly caused by the privilege is justified in part by the fact that without the privilege, the client may not have made such communications in the first place. So I believe strongly that without the privilege, victim survivors won't have those conversations with their advocate, so they won't be there to be able to get access to. As related to using that information potentially in a prosecution for a murder, I would say two things. First of all, in my 19 and a half years that I worked with domestic and sexual violence organizations around these issues, not that I can remember a program calling me saying that that a prosecution has subpoenaed them to testify about what a victim told them after that victim had been murdered. So I can't think of a case where that's happened, and that could have happened up to this point, and it hasn't. Secondly, I would say that if a victim has those concerns, they can always sign a release of information before and allow a release of information saying, if this happens to me, here are the things you can disclose. And I've definitely worked with domestic violence advocates and sexual violence advocates who have gotten those types of releases. We call them victim offender folders, and encourage advocacy that if they are working with somebody who is really scared, that is an option that they can also go down to help if they want to get that information out.
Representative Hudson, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for those robust answers. I'm very encouraged to hear that, and I don't want to go so far necessarily as to codify a requirement for that, But I definitely would encourage the continuation of that practice if victims in foresight are willing to have information disclosed after something like that happens. I think that's the best practice. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for asking the question on exculpatory evidence. And I've shared this with the bill's author. In my work in family law and all of that, I've seen where there's false allegations made about the dad. And my question had been, you know, what if they confide in this this advocate, but that's the only person that they tell that, hey, I'm just doing this so I can get custody of my kids or whatever it is. And so that was one of the concerns that I had with the bill. I definitely want to protect people that are you know, under threat. But just because of my past with that, it was a question that I had in my mind. So thank you for asking the question. Next on the list, Representative Duran.
Actually, Representative Hudson asked my questions for me. But I would actually just like to throw my support out for this bill. I think it's getting to a point, and you know, when I was on the board of directors for the sexual assault program in Bemidji, I've heard a lot of different stories and a lot of different situations where a lot of people were concerned about filing reports or coming out there just because they don't want their words to get out there. And it's pretty powerful to be able to know that there's a place where they can go and feel comfort and getting that stuff out there and getting the right help. So this is a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Duran. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And like everyone, I want to thank you. Thank you both for your bill. I'm a strong advocate on these issues, Representative Chair Moeller, and I'm always honored to work with you on these issues. I specifically want to thank you and draw out that question about non-reporting. I'm going to talk a little bit about my community. You know, domestic violence is a problem for women. We know the rates that women face domestic violence. Trans women face that violence at rates 4 times higher than cisgender women. And to Representative Hudson's question, which is actually where I wanted to go, domestic violence often leads to murder. And the murder of trans women in domestic violence is 7 times higher than cisgender women. These problems are pervasive in all of our communities. And we know, I know as an advocate in my community, that transgender people are far less likely also to report. Systems have been distrusted for a long time. Criminalization of trans people continues to be a problem federally across the country. And, you know, we continue to have those conversations here. And I'm really curious to know, you know, what can we do after we pass this bill? I trust that Representative Curran will ensure that that takes place. What can we do to start building trust with our advocates in communities like the trans community, especially Black trans community that faces these things, just at unbelievable rates of violence? Because we really need to start healing those things so people can start reporting and their lives can be saved.
Representative Finke, is that to the testifier?
It's to the panel.
Okay, to the panel. Who wants to start?
Okay, yeah, I'll start.
Okay, go ahead, sure. Representative Waller.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. And those statistics are terrible. We do have great advocacy programs in the state. We do have some that are specifically based to help certain communities. I know Violence Free Minnesota is in the room too, so I don't know if they want to chime in on those kinds of protections. But I mean, the first thing is making sure people realize that their communications are absolutely confidential and privileged so that they will get the help that they deserve and need. And as my testifier explained, that Supreme Court case that said, like, people aren't going to have these communications if they don't know. So part of it will definitely be getting the word out that those communications are protected and that they're important, because not every victim is going to choose the court system either. There are many victim survivors who will seek services by advocates, whether that's domestic violence or sexual assault advocates, and won't ever go into the court process. I mean, it is up to you know, the victim if they're going to report it or not. So I think at the very, at the bare minimum, we should make sure that people know that they have these services available. There is a hotline, a 24-hour hotline, too, that victim survivors can call and get information. I see Violence Free is nodding their head yes. I don't know if they have more that they want to add to this discussion. And I know Representative Rarick, I think, had something to say as well.
Representative, I noticed that the Violence Free is like, no, don't call me. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Well, I was actually just going to reference their letter. So in lieu of them coming up, so they have a three-page handout, and it's really illustrative. It talks about, if you look at the third page, there's a great little chart, and it kind of goes to what you were saying. So what happens in the system, which is inside the circle, and then what they do on the outside. So I'm a visual person, so this is helpful to me. Once Violence Free Minnesota messages it, it'll be in all of these places out here. So, because they're very good at that. Violence Free Minnesota is very, very good at messaging and getting the information out to their advocates. But all of these advocates out here will be getting that information. The other thing I was going to say is, you've got a great member here that she and I have worked, Representative Mueller and I have worked for many years and have been on multiple interviews with TV stations and news stations about some other things that we worked on. So I would imagine that if, you know, once this gets passed or if we need help getting it passed, that's another avenue as well. So you've got two very powerful people here to get the message out. I wanted to circle back since I have the mic really quick. If you also look at the front page of Violence Free Minnesota, the fourth paragraph down, this hasn't been mentioned yet, but I think it's one of the most critical parts of this bill. And it says specifically some of the information that could be incredibly dangerous to the victim survivor. So if they get a new address, if they have a new place of employment, if they have the addresses of their children or their family members, the date and time and place of appointments where they could be intercepted. But that communication cannot get out. Those are things that are absolutely critical. And there's a big question whether or not that information could be obtained. So we're talking about, you know, we talked about murder. Well, these are the things that lead to that, when they can have access to that victim. So I just wanted to point that out since I have the mic. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Alexander, did you have anything to add?
Yes, if that's all right, Madam Chair. I also would like to point out that in Minnesota we have Outfront, which is a organization that does a variety of things as it relates to the LGBTQ community. Specifically, they do have domestic and sexual violence programming at Outfront. So if somebody is experiencing domestic or sexual violence and they would like support from a organization that specifically works with trans folks, please reach out to Outfront. Otherwise, all domestic and sexual violence programs in the state of Minnesota should provide services to trans folks. I will say, though, that the federal government is demanding that domestic and sexual violence programs remove any information about trans folks from their websites and from their communications. While there may be programs who have made that choice to try to do that in hopes that they can stay financially open, I still encourage trans folks, please utilize those services. They are available to you. Just because their website may not say it, they will provide services to you. And I'm deeply sorry that I even had to say that.
Representative Finke, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate all of those answers. I know that the champion that Representative Mueller is and yourself, Representative Rarick, and that SHOULD is doing a lot of work. All of these agencies and organizations should be serving trans people. There are trans people in all of your districts, and I would really ask for the help of all of you to make sure that our trans community is being served by these important organizations everywhere.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also support the bill. And one of the things I find really compelling about the testimony is that, and about the bill, is aligning the standards for sexual assault and for domestic abuse. I think that's really important. But I also just want to say a couple things. First of all, well, maybe it's really a question to Mr. Johnson. I thought that, a privilege would not survive the death of the person who held the privilege. I mean, I would think that if, you know, going back to this question people were talking about if somebody dies and what about can that be discovered for use in prosecuting the someone who might have murdered that victim, I would think that that would be actually admissible evidence and that it could survive, that the privilege doesn't survive their death. But you're saying it does survive, the privilege actually survives the death of the person? Maybe Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, if you want to answer that, yeah.
Chair Scott, members, I would agree with the nodding heads up there that in general privileges do survive the death of the person.
Okay.
Okay. Chair Liebling? Representative Mueller.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Liebling, too. Yes, there is a specific case on attorney-client privilege in Minnesota that does say that it survives the death. I think to the point that Representative Hudson raised earlier, though, and the idea of having these consent forms is a really, you know, great one. And I know, again, Violence Free is in the room, and they work on training advocates, and so really encouraging the use of those kinds of consent in the event that the victim does end up dying.
Okay. Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And so the other thing I just wanted to say is I kind of want to align myself here with Chair Scott and Representative Hudson on the kind of to say as a person who's done a lot of criminal defense work, when we talk about these issues, it's really easy to say and to sort of think in the frame that everybody is actually a victim who says that something has happened to them. And I will say most of the time that is the case. I don't think there's a lot of people just making up stuff for advantage, but it does happen. It does happen. And due process is not just something we hold on to because it sounds nice or it's in the Constitution, et cetera. It's obviously the point of our criminal justice system is to try to get to the truth. And the cases that get to trial tend to be the ones that are weird for some reason, right? So I just really want to raise that, just to say that we need to kind of keep that in mind. Even though I do support the bill, you know, confidentiality for victims of domestic abuse is incredibly important for all the reasons that you have all articulated so well. But we can't also forget about the fact that the search for truth, you know, when I know Representative Mueller, we're kind of, you do prosecution and I've done defense. And so we have this little bit of a difference of perspective on what these cases are. When we talk about how harmful it is for defense attorneys to kind of do this searching through information, you know, the defense attorney's job is when the client says, I didn't do that, is to try to figure out and help to bring that point of view forward so it can be adjudicated. And there are cases where people, it looks really bad, but in fact, people didn't do something. And we want to just be careful that we guard the ability for people to fight charges that in fact aren't true, even though that is rare, admittedly. So while we want to protect victims, we also have that, just like in everything, right, there is a balance here. So I just wanted to raise that up. And with that said, I do very much appreciate the bill. I hope that you will, you know, work with MACDL, the defense lawyers, so that we can get an appropriate amendment to make sure that that is protected because of those, you know, where, and I've told this to Representative Mueller, when you're a defense attorney and you are defending someone who you really, really think is innocent, it's the scariest thing in the world. Because the power of the state is aligned against that person, and it is a lot of power. And it's your job to try to help to show that, in fact, that person is innocent. And our system is really designed to not convict the innocent. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing. And So I think this does strike the right balance if we have some additional language such as you've been working on, Representative Mueller. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Mueller, any final comments?
Yeah, I'll just say thank you for the great discussion today. And Chair Liebling, to your point too, you know, I would venture to say that probably most people who seek the services of a domestic violence advocate are more likely to say something that would actually help the prosecution rather than the defense, and the prosecution can't get that information either, right? Like, it is privileged and protected for a reason. But I certainly appreciate your perspective, and I do think that we'll be able to get there with the language and with the amendment that I can continue working on with MACDL and the other stakeholders. I do want to thank Representative Rarick as well, and I love that she's got her letters here highlighted and notes on it, and just really appreciate, we talked a lot about the amendment today and whether we'd actually offer it or not, and just really want to appreciate her willingness to work on this issue and her passion for domestic violence and sexual assault advocates or victims as well. So with that, just want to say thank you and hope everybody can support this bill moving forward.
All right. With that, Representative Mueller renews her motion that House File 1083 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you so much. Members, what a great committee today. Lots of really good discussion. And with that, we are adjourned. I let you out early. 45 minutes you got.